Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings to all of you from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets. My not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. So how's it going in your neck of the woods? Feels like a long time since I've been in the chair here, so we're going to pack the next few hours with as much coast-type material as is humanly or inhumanly possible tonight. We are what we are, after all. So you've heard me mention my unified theory of weirdness idea multiple times over the years with multiple guests. The concept that maybe a lot of these subjects that we discuss on this program are connected at some level. That maybe there is another intelligence, maybe many intelligences that interact with us in various ways. They inject themselves into our world from their world, sometimes in physical form, sometimes not physical, and then poof, they're gone. And it's this ephemeral quality. It's here one minute, gone the next, non-reproducible, certainly non-reproducible in a lab, that drives so many mainstream scientists and journalists and other professionals away from taking any of this stuff seriously. Tonight, a kindred spirit in the quest for the unified theory, Tom Powell, is a science teacher and writer and outdoor expert whose journey down this same road started with an interest in Bigfoot. Then it led him to places and subjects that he never quite imagined could be connected. Like any honest investigator of the unknown, he's tried to follow the evidence wherever it leads, no matter how preposterous it might seem to someone on the outside of the big tent. For him, Bigfoot begat something else, a big, wide, wonderful world of weirdness. ETs, maybe? Other beings? Other realities? Other people have arrived at this same point as Tom after starting somewhere other than Bigfoot. So the how and the why of his journey is what we're going to hear tonight in the second half of this program. His book is called Edges of Science, and we're really happy to welcome Tom Powell back to Coast. That's coming up a little bit later. First, though, Marilyn Monroe. I was just a kid, a youngster, when she was at the apex of her career, and I remember even at a young age, it was hard to take your eyes off of her. It's like she came from another planet. Her death in 1962 at the age of 36 was headline news all over the world. It's a terribly sad story. It looked like either an accidental overdose of sleeping pills or barbiturates or perhaps even a suicide. The sordid details about her personal struggles and personal demons came spilling out in the years that followed. And then eventually we heard even darker whispers, affairs she may have had with President John F. Kennedy, and then his brother Bobby, the Attorney General. Questions about whether she may have been killed to keep quiet about the scandalous affairs with these powerful married men. And every once in a while, her name would come up in the UFO world. I'd read about it, little bits and pieces. Maybe she learned something during these pillow talk sessions and that's why she was murdered. Seemed like a stretch to me, but now I'm not so sure. Writer, producer, director Paul Davids, who's been my guest a couple of times over the years on this program, has put together the definitive look into Marilyn Monroe's death. Pieces of evidence, in particular, at least for me, he's pulled together these different threads, interviews, most importantly for me, though, a paper trail, previously unreleased documents from the files of these three-letter agencies that spell the details out in graphic ways. All of this has been weaved together into one huge, comprehensive, mind-boggling tapestry, and it's a masterpiece in the conspiracy genre. Not only involves JFK and RFK, but various Hollywood moguls, the CIA, the FBI, the mob, private investigators, secret surveillance. Names are named, fingers are pointed, and best of all, looks like one common denominator, could be government knowledge about ETs and UFOs, and maybe, just maybe, my favorite military base of all time, that place that didn't exist on a map. I don't even have to name it for you. Whether it extends that far, we'll see when Paul Davids joins us in just a minute or so to dive headfirst into his documentary film, Marilyn Monroe Declassified. Should be a lot of fun, and maybe a little bit troubling as well. If you haven't been on the Coast to Coast website in a while, you're in for a surprise. It's been redesigned, looks great. I know many of you were, you know, like me, you're used to the previous design. You can figure your way around on how it was. This one is user-friendly. I was on there looking around yesterday and today, and even a Luddite technophobe like me found it to be a big improvement. So check it out for yourselves. Do some exploring while you're there. Webmaster Lex and I have put together our usual assortment of oddities and items culled from various media outlets around the world. We call it Naps News. Tonight's collection has some compelling information you may not have seen elsewhere. One article is proof of the enduring power of Marilyn Monroe. I mean, Icon doesn't describe it. One of her dresses was sold a couple of days ago. Check out the price, what people paid for this thing. Another story is about the discovery of an unusual megalith. It's near the Sea of Galilee. It's been in plain sight for centuries, but nobody really noticed what it was. And now it has the experts stumped. What was it built for and by whom? Check out the piece. Another story there, the folks at DARPA are building a new kind of drone, as if we don't have enough of those. This one's going to give government spooks a whole new level of ability to watch everything that you or I do, no matter where we go, anywhere on the planet. Good or bad, you make the call on that one. And we got a story about something I spent a lot of time pondering, shapeshifters. The title of the story mentions werewolves, but the theme is much broader than that. Hollywood didn't create the werewolf myth. It's been around as long as humans have been here. Every culture on every continent throughout human history has had stories about these shapeshifters in one form or another. And I think this might even be a factor when we get into the Bigfoot discussion that we'll be having later in the program. And if werewolves don't grab you, how about polar bears? I know the subject of climate change is touchy for a lot of people, but if you like having polar bears on Earth, who doesn't? Give this a read. That and more in Naps News on the Coast website. While you're there, look for the word subscribe. It's up in the right-hand corner, I think. Under that link is information on how you can become a Coast Insider. You know the deal. We've told you about it before. For pennies a day, you get to listen to the program anytime you want, anywhere, on any device, and as often as you want. It also gives you access to a vast archive of previous programs and interviews, George Norrie and Art Bell and all the other talented hosts and guests. It's a great deal. While you're there, you can see how to subscribe to George Norrie's television program, Beyond Belief, which, as many of you may know, it covers a lot of the same kind of topics as the radio show, but of course, it's TV, it's video. With that, let's get serious and get ready. You know the drill. The dog and cat should already be in the house. Fluff up a pillow for them near your feet. Brew up a pot of Joe. Toss a log onto the fire. Slip into those silky jammies, maybe the robe too, depending on how cold it is where you live. Turn down the lights, turn up the radio, and plop yourself down in that comfy recliner because we're about ready to rumble. In a moment, Paul Davids, the ultimate Marilyn Monroe conspiracy, Marilyn Declassified. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. You know, millions of people around the world and certainly around the country are thinking about John F. Kennedy this week, this month. On this date, in 1963, President Kennedy was spending his final night in the White House. 2 days later, as we all know, he was killed in Dallas. That event changed the country. It changed the world, and we're still feeling the effects more than half a century later. This morning, I slipped the Blu-ray disc into the machine and watched the new documentary about Marilyn Monroe, Marilyn Declassified, and figured I'd take a few notes, use them as a guide for the interview tonight. I ended up writing 9 pages of stuff down in my hard-to-read scribble. The program is densely packed with materials gleaned from what certainly appears to be a very ambitious research project. Our guest apparently cast a wide net, pulled together all these bits and pieces from over the years across the globe, and really makes it into a compelling case, the idea that an iconic, beautiful actress, a tragic figure in many ways, was murdered, that she may have been a pawn in a much larger and more sordid story, even bigger than a mere sex scandal with the president, and that the details of this crime were covered up, and it's really disturbing. You know, we're not naive here. We know about what the government does at times. But you're about to hear a story that I think really drives home this point. Paul Davids is no stranger to the program. You know him for work on Roswell and UFO secrecy issues. He was my guest earlier this year to talk about a ghost, the ghost investigation involving a former friend of his. He is a graduate of Princeton University and the American Film Institute Center for Advanced Film Studies. Welcome back to the program, producer, writer, director Paul Davids. Paul, good to have you back.
Thank you, George. It's always good to have a fireside chat with you.
So let's talk about Marilyn a little bit and set the stage here. Marilyn as an icon. You note in the new film project that she might be a bigger star in death than she was in life, and that's saying a lot because in life she was as big as stars get.
Well, yeah, that's true. I mean, as you mentioned, if you look at the prices that things that belong to her, such as dresses, sell for at auctions these days, absolutely enormous. So in terms of collectibles, how far her image has spread, how frequently we see her today, it's amazing because the younger generation probably doesn't know her films that well. I mean, we grew up with them, love them, you know, great comedies and sometimes musicals. And Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend. You know, she was a superstar in life, but in death, she has become legend and myth on a grandiose scale. You know, and it parallels a bit what you could say about JFK, I think.
I was thinking about Elvis too, as I'm watching your film about all the different products she's on. You know, the iconic Andy Warhol imagery, and she's on lunchboxes and keychains and
yep.
T-shirts and posters and everything. What the Elvis estate? I know jealously guards anything with his name or image attached to it. How does it work with Marilyn? Does she have an estate? Does she have heirs, or where do all those millions of dollars go?
Well, she didn't have heirs. I mean, she had no she left
no kids
behind.
Right.
And things have fallen into the hands of collectors through the years. You know, I referred to the white dress from 7 Year Itch, sold for around $6 million at auction by Profiles in History out in Calabasas. I think that collectors have hoarded everything that they can. It's very hard to get a hold of these items. By the way, I wanted to correct, you know, on the title of the movie.
Yeah, it's Marilyn Monroe Declassified.
Marilyn, yeah, her last name's here, Marilyn Monroe Declassified.
Right.
Whereas the website is MarilynDeclassified.com. So, yes, I got into quite a hornet's nest when I got involved in this project. I knew it was going to be complicated.
Yeah, well, you've got all these clips from all over the place, different programs and documentaries and then movie clips. I mean,
you know, the thinking,
you had to deal with lawyers, I can imagine.
The thinking, George, was this, more or less. When she died, and actually she passed on August 4th, 1962, not the 5th, as is often said. But when she died, the coroner declared her death a probable suicide. And that word probable is almost never used in a case like this. You know, there was no suicide note. And the finding was very, very quickly contested by many people that were involved, particularly Sergeant Jack Clemens, the first policeman who was at the scene, and the assistant coroner Lionel Grandison. I mean, even right then in 1962, there were people objecting, but it was never handled as a criminal case, so there was no grand jury. 20 years or so later, there was an attempt to put a grand jury together as evidence came out and solidified that made it look like murder, that Marilyn was a hit, was a contract killing. And, you know, one of my difficulties and problems in approaching this, and one of the reasons I stuck so closely to all the original material, the original testimony, going right back to the people that were involved, let's hear it, you know, from the real people, because the tabloid world has had such a go with this story. There's been so much disinformation. There's been so many false stories, outright false stories. You know, I think it was sometime within the last year or so that there was a fake news story on the internet claiming that a CIA agent named Norman Hodges, on his deathbed, had confessed that he had murdered Marilyn Monroe. And, you know, it had tip-offs in it of things that were so absurd that you couldn't take it seriously. For example, claiming she had an affair with Fidel Castro, the communist dictator of Cuba, which, you know, that should get people's suspicion up. But the fake news story just spread like wildfire everywhere. I had people calling me up saying, do you know now that, you know, this dying CIA agent has confessed? And it was absolute nonsense. It's just absolutely made up. There is no Norman Hodges.
Well, I guess we should all get used to fake news stories. There's a lot of that floating around.
Yeah, it's one of the things we really have to watch out for today. It's happening all the time. I think there was just recently a story, John Travolta died. You know, not true, but these things spread at the speed of light.
Before we get into the specifics about the kinds of stuff that's in the program, tell me about how you started down this road. What prompted you to dive into this?
Good question. And
how long did you spend on it?
I think I spent about 2.5 years. And fortunately, it got picked up for release by a New York company called FilmRise. So it is now out and available as a Blu-ray or DVD. You know, you can't see it at Netflix yet. And I don't think it's up for streaming yet. I think sometime next year it will. But the DVD and Blu-ray are out there. So it was about, I'd say, good 2.5 years. But the reason this project spoke to me was in many ways personal. In my own personal history, let me say that my dad, Dr. Jules Davids, was a very famous professor of American history, American diplomatic history at Georgetown University. He was one of the founding fathers of the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown. And he had famous students. In 1968, young Bill Clinton was in his class. And earlier than that, Jackie Kennedy was in his class taking a course when Jack Kennedy was still a senator thinking of running for president. So this was about the mid-1950s, and my dad was called in by, there was Ted Sorensen, who wrote a lot of the president's of JFK speeches, and JFK called my dad into meetings to help prepare the book Profiles in Courage. And my dad did write first drafts of 5 of the 9 chapters of the book. And this is now pretty much common knowledge. I mean, if you research Dr. Jules Davids and who wrote Profiles in Courage, my dad's name will come up, Ted Sorensen's name comes up. And now even the Kennedy Library makes available at least one of my dad's first draft chapters. Now, my dad wouldn't exactly say ghostwriter. It's more like, you know, in the movie business, you have a screenplay writer who writes the actual script, the final words, and shots and scenes, and then you have a treatment writer who kind of writes the story that it springs from. So my dad was more like the treatment writer. He gave the basis for the chapters and choosing the senators who showed political courage. So my family had this Kennedy connection, and we were very involved in, my dad, in withholding information about his contribution during that election. He didn't want to help Nixon get elected. And just through the years, my mother guarded all the papers, and we have Kennedy letters. So that was part of it, knowing the family connection with John F. Kennedy, and then his relationship with Marilyn Monroe. You know, I've been in the film business my whole life. I see Marilyn Monroe as this great icon here. I love her movies. The fact that those two were involved and romantically involved while he was married to Jackie Kennedy is astonishing, sensational, but it's fact. I don't think anybody disputes that anymore. It was first raised by Norman Mailer in his book on Marilyn. It was the first time the connection between JFK and Marilyn was mentioned. So there was that. But the other thing, George, that really connected for me, as you know, I was executive producer of Roswell, the Showtime movie. It's a cult classic now, sometimes called Roswell, the UFO cover-up. And it has Kyle MacLachlan of Twin Peaks. It has Dwight Yoakam. It has Martin Sheen. And my goal in that movie was to take the facts of the Roswell case as best we could know them from those who withheld facts for decades.
I'm going to ask you to hold on here, Paul. That music is telling us we need to go to a break. We'll pick up that thought on the other side. Def Leppard, Photograph from 1983, one of hundreds of songs that have invoked the name or image of the screen icon Marilyn Monroe. We'll be back in a moment. The great Marvin Gaye, Inner City Blues, a song from a landmark album, 1971's What's Going On, and the Funk Brothers, as always, laying it down. Food for thought in that song. You know, I'd ask the question about who benefits. Who got Marilyn Monroe's estate? She generates about up to $6 million a year for the use of her image, and one of our listeners sent me an article during the break. Joe sent this article that says Lee Strasberg got everything, that Marilyn Monroe left everything to the great acting coach. He married a much younger woman later in his life, a woman who had never met Marilyn Monroe. When Strasberg died, everything went to her. So a woman who was a complete stranger to Marilyn Monroe now, according to this article, gets all of it. We're talking with Paul Davids about his new film, Marilyn Monroe Declassified. And in this next segment, we're going to get into the evidence that suggests that she was murdered, by whom, and why. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Paul Davids, before the break, you were telling me about sort of the personal angle, the family connection between your family and the Kennedy family, how your father had worked with and for JFK, and in effect helped shape the image of him, the public image that so many of us still have. Here's the son, though. You're kind of you're breaking that image into a bunch of pieces in this film.
Yes, I think that's fair to say. I also mentioned, you know, the fact that I made the film Roswell for Showtime, and the Roswell connection, the knowledge of extraterrestrial contact when it first happened, the cover-up, the fact that it's classified, it's always been classified, and the reports that Marilyn picked up a lot of things sort of in pillow talk from JFK. He compromised himself. He told her things that she had no business to know. You know, that would include the attempted assassination of Fidel Castro, the assassination of Trujillo of the Dominican Republic. She asked questions about H-bomb tests. We know this from FBI wiretap reports on her conversations with him. And one very interesting document from the CIA mentions her having been told about JFK's visit to a secret airbase for the purpose of examining things from outer space. And Dorothy Kilgallen, who was one of the people being wiretapped there, speculated then that it referred to the flying saucer crash in the Southwest in the late 1940s. So all information she shouldn't have had. I call it Marilyn Monroe Declassified because although there have been many very good books written about Marilyn and her death, some of which I would highly recommend, and some very good documentary programs, none of them really take us up to the present and integrate the declassified FBI documents and this key CIA document in order to put all the pieces together of the story. That's what I've tried to do.
Well, like I said, you cast a very wide net and you pull together a bunch of different interviews from different programs, bits and pieces from different books, film authorities, it's a lot of research that you boil down. This document, though, that is revealed, you hint about it early in the program and then you lay it out later on. We might as well, since you mentioned it, jump into it now. Who found it? How did they get it? What does it say?
Well, the document first surfaced not through the normal procedure of declassification. The story is that it came from a CIA archivist who was leaking it into the public domain, let's say in Edward Snowden's style, but way before Edward Snowden. And it was it came to the attention of Timothy Good. Stephen Greer has done some work on it. Donald Burleson of Roswell has written a book on the CIA and the murder of Marilyn Monroe, a whole book talking about the details of this one particular document. Now, the first question would be, well, how do we know it's real if it wasn't declassified through the normal channels? And some people have attacked it and questioned it. But we do know that it's real. And we know that through the fact that Don Burleson went through a very lengthy and complex procedure with the CIA under the Freedom of Information Act to try to obtain transcripts of the wiretaps that are referred to in the document. And he went through a first round where the CIA responded that they couldn't find the wiretaps responsive to his request, but they told him he was entitled to attempt an appeal. So he prepared the appeal in a timely way. And the key thing here is that the CIA accepted the appeal on the basis of that document. And they would not have accepted the appeal process under Freedom of Information had the document not been theirs, if they didn't know that it was theirs. They would have just sent it back, scratched with bogus, the word bogus over it, as has been done with other documents, like the MJ-12 documents. The FBI kicked them back to those who were acquiring with the words bogus written, you know, so big you couldn't even read the document.
So other people had filed Freedom of Information Act requests about Marilyn Monroe, the JFK angle, and this document doesn't show up. Suddenly it appears in some archive somewhere as somebody had slipped it in, and it goes public, and somebody finds it, and it's sensational stuff.
Well, especially because it was signed the day before she died, and the man that signed it was James Angleton, the director of counterintelligence in those days for the CIA. He had been with the CIA for decades, you know, forever. He was the spy that no president could ever get rid of, nor could any CIA director, because he knew too much, until finally, I think it was Colby, finally eased him out of the CIA, and they felt that he'd become very, very paranoid. But he was the mole hunter. And he shows up in a very devastating way, both in the Marilyn Monroe case, because this document shows his awareness of what classified information Marilyn was being told through these wiretaps. But he also shows up in the case of another of JFK's mistresses, Mary Pinchot Meyer, who was assassinated about 1 year after JFK's death. She was shot 2 times while jogging near her home in Georgetown. And this was about a week after the Warren Report had come out on Kennedy's death. And she didn't believe the Warren Report. Her name was Mary Pinchot Meyer because she was married to Cord Meyer, who was one of the top people at the CIA, who certainly worked with James Angleton. And she knew that the Warren Report was giving the public a bogus story about the death of President Kennedy, and she was prepared to talk. And she, too, had writings and a diary. And it's very, very fascinating that we know from the publisher of the Washington Post at that time, Ben Bradley, from his autobiography, The Good Life, he talks about when Mary Pinchot Meyer was assassinated, that because she was sort of distantly related to him, he went to her house looking for her writings and personal materials. And when he got there, he found that James Angleton of the CIA had already broken into her house and was searching for her diary. So it's amazing how those two stories intertwined. That one is brilliantly told in a great book called Mary's Mosaic by Peter Janney, who I happened to go to Princeton with at the same time we were students at Princeton.
So Angleton, who is sort of the dirty tricks guy at the CIA, has this document in his hand. He reads on August 3rd, Marilyn Monroe has been told a bunch of stuff. According to different wiretaps, surveillance recordings from her phone, she has been told about a variety of top secret stuff, including that President Kennedy had visited an unnamed airbase and seen evidence of ETs, UFOs.
Yeah, they didn't use the word ET or UFO. Right. It was things from outer space. But at that time, back in those days, what could these things from outer space be? I mean, we're just in the immediate post-Sputnik era.
So that date is August 3rd. Angleton sees the memo on August 3rd. August 4th, Marilyn Monroe is dead.
Yeah, he signs the memo on that day. Now, one of the things that became really interesting to me in this long, long string of research I did and putting together all of this testimony through the years of all the people involved and also how they changed their testimony 20 years later and began to tell the truth about things that they had lied about for 20 years, we see that gradually emerge. It's like a photo, you know, in the old days in developer solutions, seeing the photo come out.
Right.
In addition to all of that process, we get to the point where Sam Giancana's family comes out with a book called Double Cross.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, Paul, we're jumping ahead of ourselves here.
Okay.
Yeah, let me hold on that. Let's build this a little bit more. Let's talk about the death scene. What's the problem with the physical evidence? So she dies at around midnight.
Earlier.
Okay. How'd you get into that?
Yeah, we think it was around probably between 9 and 10 p.m. on August 4th. And we know this because Pat Newcomb, who's still alive and who does not talk on this, and who I publicly invite to finally talk now, she called the publicist for Marilyn Monroe, that she worked with, Arthur Jacobs, who was at a Henry Mancini concert at the Hollywood Bowl. So he was able to put the time to that. And this was, before the concert was over, so we're thinking 10 p.m., but they don't report her death until about 5:30 a.m. So you've got more than 6 hours that goes by where there's a group of people that know Marilyn is dead under very suspicious circumstances and are fooling around with the evidence at the death scene before they call it in. And The group includes Peter Lawford, a brother-in-law to President Kennedy, whose phone was tapped like Marilyn's throughout this whole period of time. It includes one of the people that had been wiretapping Marilyn's house and Peter Lawford's house. Let's see, that was Fred Otash, who worked with another wiretapper, Bernard Spindell. And really, really important testimony, which I found.
Yeah, well, let me reel you back in here for a second.
You got it.
Let's just deal with the timeline of her dying.
Okay.
So somebody discovers it and they call it in. When do they discover it and when is it called in?
So it's discovered around 10 p.m. and it's called in about 6 hours later with a completely false story about how the body was discovered.
And it's by the housekeeper?
The psychiatrist, Ralph Greenson, actually made the phone call to a desk sergeant to report that she was dead. He was with the housekeeper, Eunice Murray, at the house at that time. But the reason, let me just mention this testimony from one of the subsequent police chiefs of Los Angeles, Tom Redden. So, so important to have this and to be able to see it in his own words, because I think it was only broadcast once and then vanished. And, I've got it in this movie. Tom Redden saying that the aftermath of her death was handled as a top secret intelligence operation with utmost secrecy because of the involvement of the Attorney General of the United States, Robert F. Kennedy. He says it absolutely point blank. So then we have to unravel that. How was Robert Kennedy involved? How do we?
Yeah, let's just stick with.
Okay.
How did she die? What killed her? What is the official explanation of what killed her? And what's the problem with that explanation?
She it was an overdose of Nembutal and chlorohydrate. And these were drugs that she was taking. Nembutal is also a drug that was used for contract killings by the mob. There was a lot of problems with the evidence of claiming that she had just overdosed herself with pills. There was no crystalline residue found in the stomach as normally would be found. No residue from the capsules. The blood toxicity level had reached a level so high that even the company that makes Nembutal, you know, the indication was she would have been dead before she could have swallowed that many pills. There was no glass of water found in the room. Her body, unclothed, was laid out almost staged. It looked staged on the bed, reported Sergeant Clemens. He had seen many overdose deaths like this, and people are, you know, they're contorted. There's vomit. There would be, you know, there was none of that in this circumstance. So everything about it was fishy from the get-go to the sergeant who showed up 6 hours after she died. And he couldn't get a reasonable explanation as to why they waited so long to report it. Of course, they fudged on the time of death. They said, 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock a.m. And then they said, well, no, maybe it was around midnight. But it was, they said they were trying to get in touch with the publicity department from the studio. But we know the publicity department from the studio, Arthur Jacobs, knew that at 10 p.m. So lies, 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 right from the beginning. And the coroner continues it. That's Kerfey. And Noguchi at that time was working with him as sort of an assistant. He wasn't a full coroner at that time. But the samples, the biological tissue samples collected by Noguchi and sent to the lab for further analysis were all destroyed against his instructions without those further tests being made.
So they couldn't have a definitive answer to it. And there was also something you mentioned in the film about her colon.
Very important point, that they found a purplish discoloration of intense inflammation of the colon at, I think, the point where the small intestine and the large intestine meet, that would have been consistent with an injected suppository through the anus. And that holds up the best with all of the evidence. There was it an enema? They don't think it was an enema. Was she injected with something? Some book authors claim that there were objections, that there were injections that were covered up in the autopsy report. Authors such as Jay Margolis and Richard Buskin in their book, The Murder of Marilyn Monroe. But the autopsy report, you know, denies any injections. They did withhold the information that they saw bruises on her back. That came out later. So,
the cause of death is not what it was reported to be. You have different people in the medical examiner and a coroner's office who had their suspicions at the time and within the police department, but who generally keep it quiet or they're muzzled.
Yeah.
But as you said, later they start coming forward, some of them to tell the story for the first time and some of them to change to tell a much different story. Thomas Noguchi was an assistant coroner or medical examiner at the time, became a pretty famous guy years later, but you include some sound bites from him in the film in which he says flat out that the official conclusion is wrong, right?
That he has doubts about the official conclusion. And when they ask, you know, could it have been murdered, he said, you know, could be.
And I guess then the question becomes who did it and who would have been responsible? You make a pretty compelling case in this film that both John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy had affairs with Marilyn Monroe.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people have speculated, well, Joe Kennedy had his own mob connections. Maybe he had some mobsters take care of this so his sons would not be embroiled in a scandal. But your film goes in a much different direction. We're going to take a break now. When we come back, I'm going to ask you to sort of lay out the evidence about who else may have been involved and what the evidence shows as a possible motive. We're talking with Paul Davids about his new film, Marilyn Monroe Declassified. It's something you got to see. It's on Blu-ray and DVD now, and will be available in other formats later. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM.